Pope Leo XIV is just 2 weeks into his pontificate. The National Catholic Register's senior Vatican correspondent, Ed Penton, and editor of Catholic World News, Philip Lawler, will tell us what his first moves could reveal about his papacy. And San Francisco Archbishop Salvatore Corleone tells us what his recent appointment to the White House's newly established Religious Liberty Commission could look like. And what might Pope Leo do to reset that controversial Vatican-China deal? Director of the Center for Religious Freedom, Nina Shea, shares her thoughts. And actor-producer Neil McDonough shares his Catholic faith in his terrific new movie in theaters this week, The Last Rodeo. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond DeRoy.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond DeRoy. Or at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. It's been a month since the passing of Pope Francis, and the pontificate of Leo XIV continues to unfold. Here with analysis on the latest from Rome this week, I'm joined by senior Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Register and co-founder of the College of Cardinals Report.com, Edward Penton, and editor-in-chief of the Catholic World News, Philip Lawler. Thank you both for being here, gents. Exactly 2 weeks into this new pontificate, some significant appointments were announced, including Leo's first curial appointment. That's the Vatican bureaucracy. Pope Leo has named Sister Tiziana Merletti, the former Superior General of the Franciscan Sisters of the Poor, as Secretary of the Dicastery for Institutes of Consecrated Life and Societies of Apostolic Life. She will serve under another nun, Sister Simona Brambilla, who was named prefect in January of 2025. By the way, the first woman to lead a Vatican dicastery. Ed, your thoughts on this appointment and what it says about the continuity of Pope Francis's vision continuing into this pontificate.
Sure, Raymond. Well, this is obviously very much in continuity with Francis. He was the one who sort of pioneered this, putting women into these positions. It's not so unusual in the sense that the congregation or the dicastery for religious obviously is made up of religious women. So it's probably a good thing that there is a religious women in certain positions of leadership there. I think the problem comes when women are put in positions of leading a dicastery. That happened under Francis with this dicastery, but this woman is not in that position. She's a secretary, so it's not such a major step, but it is, as I say, in continuity with that general push by Francis to place women and laity as well in positions of authority in the Roman Curia.
But Philip, weren't there canonical restrictions to having a woman lead a dicastery, an office in the Vatican prior to this?
Well, yes, I think that as Edward says, it's more of a break what Pope Francis did to appoint a woman as prefect of the dicastery. His secretary is less dramatic, mm-hmm. less concerning in itself. It is certainly a sign of continuity, but then Pope Leo has made a point throughout his public appearances to say that he would be governing in continuity with Pope Francis. So if anyone expected a very radical change, I think that was unrealistic.
Mm. To counter that argument slightly, also this week, 54-year-old Cardinal Baldessari Regna, who is the Vicar General of the Diocese of Rome, he was named by Pope Leo as Grand Chancellor of the Pontifical John Paul II Theological Institute on Marriage and Family Sciences. He replaces the controversial Archbishop Vincenzo Paglia. Edward, tell us about that appointment. Will that restore the JP2 Theological Institute after, in the estimation of many, it was gutted under Paglia and Pope Francis?
Yes, it's certainly an important appointment, Raymond. It wasn't unexpected. He's Archbishop Paglia was he just turned 80, so he was always going to quite soon. But the interesting point about this is that it's gone back to being the Vicar General of Rome, which is what it was up until 2016 when Pope Francis changed it as an exception to give it to Archbishop Palia in order to introduce these very controversial and disruptive and destructive changes to the John Paul II Institute. So what this signifies is the urgency that obviously Pope Leo feels to make this appointment, one of his first major appointments, shows that he's keen to readdress this probably. But how much this new chancellor can change things is open to question. He does have a lot of authority as Grand Chancellor, but he doesn't have the authority that was there pre 2016, when the Pope also had direct control of the Institute. So we'll see what happens there. But the key point is, I think that whether Archbishop Palia, who replaces him as head of the Pontifical Academy for Life, because that is, I think, probably a more poignant and significant change that we're going to see probably in the next few weeks or months.
Phil, another important appointment was announced this week, a replacement for former San Diego Bishop, Cardinal Robert McElroy. Pope Leo has named auxiliary bishop in San Diego as the new bishop, Michael Pham, to replace McElroy. Pham is a native of Vietnam, but will now serve this huge Vietnamese population in Southern California and San Diego. What do we know about Bishop Pham?
I know very little about him except what you just told me. I hope he's an improvement. And that's a diocese with a very disparate Catholic communities. And it's very interesting, as you say, a large Vietnamese community to have a Vietnamese bishop. I am in a wait-and-see attitude on that one, I'm afraid.
I have one of our producers actually lives in San Diego and has given me very good reports about Bishop Pham, spoken of his orthodoxy and concern for people. So this could be a vast improvement. But I'll stand with you, Phil. We'll wait and see. Moving on, Pope Leo's inaugural Mass was celebrated Sunday. He also celebrated a surprise Mass at his former post, the Dicastery for Bishops. Edward, over the last several years, Pope Francis rarely celebrated Masses publicly. Leo XIV has instituted regular celebrations of the Mass. How striking is this? Is anyone in Rome paying attention to this?
No, it's a good question, Raymond. I mean, that was something that was very much noticed, but not much discussed about the fact that the Pope Francis didn't celebrate Mass, and some say that he didn't even celebrate in private. So it was really quite significant, and to see the Pope actually celebrating Mass, and sometimes in English, is I think a very much a refreshing change for many of the faithful. So yes, it is interesting. Nobody knows quite why Pope Francis stopped. I mean, a lot of it was to do with health, of course. But even, you know, there was no real celebration either. Often, he left it to others to do altogether.
Yeah, he would preside and read the homilies, but not really celebrate the Mass. Phil, I know you wanted to weigh in on this. What does this mark? And I have to say, it is amazing listening to a Pope open his Wednesday audience in perfect English.
That is, it is, and it's fun. And of course, it's also refreshing and encouraging that it's one of several languages that he can use fluently. Regarding the celebration of Mass, I couldn't help but notice that this week the Vatican announced that Pope Leo will be celebrating Mass in public in St. Peter's or the Lateran Basilica every Sunday in June. And it struck me because for 3 years now, Pope Francis had never been the principal celebrant at a Mass in public. And I couldn't understand why more people weren't as astonished by that as I was. Surely at the end of his life, we understood the health problems, but for several years there, he was able to make public trips, foreign travel, preside at synods, have public audiences, but he couldn't celebrate Mass. The ordering of priorities there is very curious to someone looking at the Catholic Church.
Yeah, well, it is beautiful to see, you know, a Pope fully engaged and sort of flying his papal flag regularly. And as you said, we have regularly scheduled masses, which we haven't seen in a while. As we reported last week, U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, along with their families, led the U.S. delegation attending Pope Leo's inaugural mass last Sunday. And on Monday, they both were received in an audience with the Pope. This is the first formal meeting between U.S. officials and Pope Leo. Philip, there seems to be a sense that the Vatican may be setting itself up to play a role in diplomacy between Ukraine and Russia and perhaps even negotiate or host that negotiation. How likely is it, do you think?
Oh, I think it's a very real possibility. It's been brooded about by enough people coming from enough different angles so that it seems to me realistic. You probably saw this week that Prime Minister Meloni of Italy weighed in saying that her government would cooperate. And that suggests to me that she's trying to get aboard a moving train. And it would be a great thing to see at the beginning of a pontificate, something that significant on the international stage.
Yeah, I'll say. In other diplomatic news, on May 19th, Cardinal Secretary of State Pietro Parolin accepted an award by the Path to Peace Foundation at a ceremony in New York City. He accepted on behalf of the Vatican Secretariat of State, which he said, quote, works tirelessly for the Pope to promote justice in our world. Ed, given the Vatican's and Cardinal Parolin's record on China and the recent deal with the CCP on the appointment of bishops, might it be a tall order to say the Vatican works tirelessly for justice in our world?
Well, I mean, it is a pity for Cardinal Parolin that he's had this bad publicity over the China deal. And, you know, it's been criticized, obviously, with merit, many feel, for some time. But before that, he was considered very much an able diplomat and did a lot. I remember years ago, he did quite a bit behind the scenes trying to build alliances and trying to broker peace between different countries and different in different conflict areas. So he does have that reputation. And among diplomats, he does have a pretty good reputation as being somebody who can bring sides together and does work for peace. So I think it's probably more in recognition for that than anything to do with his record in China.
Mm-hmm. Phil, you want to chime in on that quickly?
Well, I think Cardinal Parolin is an effective diplomat. He was working for a pope who wanted to deal with China. And if you really want to deal with China, that gives China the bargaining advantage. I think they had the leverage throughout in the negotiations over this secret deal.
Mm-hmm. On Monday, May 19th, in an audience to representatives of other Christian communities and religions, Pope Leo said, aware, moreover, that synodality and ecumenism are closely related, I wish to assure my intention to continue Pope Francis's commitment to promoting the synodal character of the Catholic Church and developing new and concrete forms for an ever more intense synodality in the ecumenical field. Phil, given that synodality has to be one of the most undefined terms and one of the most controversial points of Pope Francis's legacy, what do you think that means?
I think the last time you had me on, I was telling you how relieved I would be if there were never another word about synodality. and that's obviously not going to come to pass. And it never was. Because the word is so ill-understood and ill-defined, the fact that Pope Leo says he's committed to it doesn't mean much to me. Again, it's a show of continuity with Pope Francis, but we'll wait and see what it means. Mm. If it means the incessant talking, discussing about what you want to discuss, then it will be very tiresome, and I doubt I will change my mind about that.
Ed, is this a continuation of the Francis Project, or do you think Pope Leo is setting up a redefinition? I mean, he is qualifying this. He says that synodality and ecumenism goes hand in hand. Well, that could just be listening to other faiths.
Yes, I think people have said that you need to look closely at his words because they don't necessarily go fully in line with what Pope Francis said about synodality. So it is interesting. It will be interesting to see just if he defines it slightly differently and tries to bring, some say perhaps bit tongue-in-cheek, but more Catholic idea of synodality rather than the synodality that that was proposed before, which many complained about, said it sort of undermined the hierarchy of the church and undermined the role of the bishops in the church. So maybe he's going to produce a sort of vision of synodality which does deal with that and tries to maintain and uphold the church's teaching and structure
Well,
and hierarchy in that sense.
Pope Leo seems to include one side and then bring in the other and then walk the middle road. So he's not irritating anybody at the end of the day, but nor is he, smashing one side or the other, which does lean into the unity mission that he gave himself when this papacy started. I'll give you the last word.
That's exactly what I've been thinking and hoping, that Pope Leo is seeing himself as fulfilling the role of Peter in uniting the apostles and being the focus of unity. And in his early days of his pontificate, he has shown that remarkable ability to say things that are reassuring to people on both sides of an issue. So if he can restore that sense of cohesion and clarity and unity, that will be a great benefit to the church.
Yeah, I mean, this week he also spoke, we didn't have time to get into it, but he talked about investing in the family founded upon the stable union of a man and a woman being the foundation of society. Again, Catholic things from a Catholic pope. Imagine that. So there seems to be that unity mission seems to be guiding his words and his actions at this point. We'll keep watching. Edward, Philip, we'll leave it there and we'll check in with you in the days ahead. Thank you. This week, I sat down with the founder of the Tunnel to Towers Foundation, Frank Siller, on the Arroyo Grande podcast. And he shared with me the deeply personal story of loss and faith that led him to found what he thought was a small organization to honor his late brother, Stephen, and all the heroic first responders who lost their lives on 9/11. Take a look. Well, I love that you gathered around Stephen when he was younger and orphaned, in your parents' death, and how the whole family surrounded him even in his passing. And he's eventually assigned to Brooklyn Squad 1, which is a fire brigade. I know he was in several, but that was where he was in 2001. You had lunch with him, Frank, on September 10th, 2001. He said what to you that day?
We were making plans because we're going to play golf the next day. And we were talking about he also worked with me in in another business because, firefighters had to work two jobs, you know that. And we were making plans for the next season. And he said, my parting words is see you tomorrow, brother. I love you. And we hugged each other. And, we thought that the next day playing golf, the four brothers were going to play golf. Russ, George, Stephen, and myself, we were just so looking forward to it. And, he was just finished his night tour in Squad 1 in Brooklyn. He was on his way home to play the golf, and he heard on his radio scanner what happened. So, what do these guys do? You know, Raymond, what do these great heroes do? He went back to his firehouse, got his gear, drove to the mouth of the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, was closed for security reasons, strapped the 60 pounds of gear on his back, and calmly ran in that tunnel. And I know it was calmly because somebody saw him come to a screeching halt in his truck, but saw him put his gear on and jog into the tunnel, came out the other side, up West Street, and while saving people in the towers, he gave up his life.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Frank Siller is available on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts. It's a moving reminder of the selfless service that I think we all should be aware of again as Memorial Day approaches. And be sure to check it out and subscribe so you don't miss an episode of the Arroyo Grande Show. And we have a new show with the Papal Posse dropping Friday. Visit RaymondArroyo.com for all those links. He's the Archbishop of San Francisco, California, and along with four other bishops, has been appointed to the White House's newly created Religious Liberty Commission. Here to tell us about that appointment and reflect on the brand new pontificate of Pope Leo XIV is Archbishop Salvatore Cordileone. Archbishop, thank you for being here. On May 1st, President Trump signed an executive order establishing this Religious Liberty Commission. He designated Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, as well as 11 other commission members, And the president designated you to serve on the advisory board of this commission. You've been a vocal defender of religious liberty for a long time. What did you think when you got the call to join this commission?
I was very happy to learn about the commission, to see that something more serious is being done to protect this God-given right of religious liberty that is enshrined in our Constitution. As you said, I've striven to defend it. We've seen encroachments on this right. It already began many years ago when we heard some politicians starting to speak of freedom of worship. So this is a subtle, you know, change the language and you win the argument. It's freedom of religion, not of worship, is one specific aspect of freedom of religion. Mm-hmm. So we saw encroachments on the right for faith communities to serve the needy in accordance with the their moral principles that are informed by their faith. So we saw those encroachments. Then we saw it much more so during COVID, where there was actually the suppression of the right to worship itself.
Right.
Though others were able to continue an operation or return to operation in similar circumstances in some parts of the country, such as our own, houses of worship were still restricted. So I was very concerned to see the government intruding more and more into the internal affairs of the church. The government, well, aside from religious liberty, I don't think the government has the right to tell anyone who's essential and who's not. The government has the duty to set policies to protect public health. Yeah. It certainly does not have the right to tell faith communities whether or not worship is essential. The whole idea of separation of church and state is that the government stays out of the affairs of the church, and the church does not control the affairs of the government. There's some mutual influence. As I said, the government has to set policies and to protect public health. We do that when we build buildings, right, for safety. We build them to code.
Right.
When we build churches. But the church has the duty to form the public moral conscience and give some guidance on moral principles for the government informing policy. So there is some, like, overlap. But in terms of attending their affairs, the church is left alone to attend to its own internal affairs. The government should not be getting involved.
Well, and you did yeoman's work throughout the COVID restrictions in California. I mean, I remember you were doing multiple masses out on your plaza and then, you know, trying to bring people back in. It was an incredible witness that I think you established. So I'm thrilled. When I saw your name on this commission, I thought, if anybody's earned the right to be there, it's Archbishop Corleone. In addition, Cardinal Dolan, Bishop Barron, Bishop Papraki, Bishop Kevin Rhodes were also named to this advisory board. Does the president's decision to include so many members of the Catholic hierarchy mean anything to you? And have they told you about the scope of this commission?
The committee itself they're still, I think, in figuring out as they go along, sort of. They know they need advice from religious leaders. So there are three advisory committees, one of which is religious leaders. Mm-hmm. They know they need advice from religious leaders. The commission is organizing some hearing sessions in different parts of the country mm-hmm. over the next year or so, to which the advisory committee members are invited to attend, not necessarily expected to attend. Mm-hmm. So they would like to hear from us there, and then we'll learn more as we go along. Yeah. The basic idea is to get input from different perspectives of different religious leaders from different faith traditions. Yeah. President Trump does seem to favor Catholics in his cabinet, and so I think he has respect for the church. And mm-hmm. as long as we maintain our integrity, I think we will be doing well.
Well, I think you'll do that. You've expressed opposition, Archbishop, to any possible insurance coverage mandates for in vitro fertilization, which, of course, the church opposes. Do you hope to influence the current administration's stance on IVF, perhaps strive for a religious exemption, which the president before the election in an interview with me said he was open to?
I certainly would push for that. In fact, I would advise for ample conscience protection. So not just church institutions, but individuals who have a conscientious objection to that should not be forced to include it in their insurance coverage.
Yeah.
So I think this would be as bad as it would be in any form. this would be something at least livable if there is ample conscience protection and religious freedom exemptions to it for institutions and individuals as well.
Yeah. The U.S. Department of Justice is currently investigating the Washington state law that seeks to force priests to violate the seal of confession if they learn about child abuse during the Sacrament of Reconciliation. Your thoughts, Archbishop, on this new law? Isn't this an obvious infringement by the government on religious liberty and, in this case, church doctrine and practice?
Very clearly, it is the government getting involved in the affairs of the church. So this is very worrisome. This is what it's happening in China, right? And it's happened in so many different forms in different parts of the world, going back to Europe, you know, with Gallicanism and all those forms of state control of the church. It's happening in China. Now it's beginning to happen here in the United States. This is the government getting involved in the internal affairs of the church.
Yeah, no, it's an egregious law that needs reexamination, and I guess they're just going to have to litigate it and see what happens. Archbishop,
yes.
There's another story. The Supreme Court this week split 4-4, ruling on whether in Oklahoma the Archdiocese wanted to open religious charter schools and have public funds go to those schools. The Supreme Court decided they were locked in, you know, 4-4, so it defaults to a lower court decision, which found that that would violate the Establishment Clause. Your take on that?
The government is not to favor any particular religion, but our founders, as we know, favored robust protections of religious liberty because religion inculcates a sense of virtue, which is necessary for democracy to work. Mm. So a religious school per se, I think the government has a duty to support all schools that are providing education to children and young people, religious schools, not to support those areas that are specific to their religion. So resources for instruction in the other subjects, you know, for special education, these sorts of things.
Right.
But the resources for their religious instruction, no. I think that distinction needs to be made.
Yeah, they could carve that out and have the charter school, you know, and have the public funding fund the rest of the school day and leave the religious practice aside.
For example, there's the practice of, you know, an hour for religious instruction, right? And even in public schools, there's an hour carve out, and not everyone has to take religious instruction. They could do a course in humanities or something else.
Yeah,
but
For some inexplicable reason, Justice Amy Coney Barrett decided to exempt herself. She recused herself from that case, which makes no sense to me. Then every Catholic would have to recuse themselves, I guess, which would be more than half the court. Pope Leo XIV was elected at the top of the month, Archbishop. How familiar were you with Cardinal Prevost and your thoughts on this pontificate so far?
To be honest, I did not know much about him. I learned a little bit about him when he was appointed to be the prefect of the Dicastery for Bishops. But I had never met him. I had never spoke to people who knew him. So I'm learning more and more after his election as Pope. And the more and more I learn, the more and more I'm impressed and encouraged. He speaks a lot of peace and unity and building bridges. I think he's he's a bridge builder. He's born, grew up in the United States, spent most of his priesthood in Peru, had experience at different high levels of leadership in the church and in administration. So he has a breadth of experience that I think will inform well his service as the Holy Father and also his vision of church governance that comes from his Augustinian background. That the leader needs to be, he has this kind of a collaborative sense. There needs to be participation, but then the leader has to decide and be firm in his decision. So I think he has a good balance and vision. He's also spoken about this synodality, but I think he will bring to it this vision that the leader eventually has to make a decision and hold to the decision while doing it in a participatory kind of a way.
Mm-hmm. Archbishop Salvatore Cordileone, always great to have you here, and we will check in with you in the days ahead. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Since the passing of Pope Francis and the ascension of Pope Leo, there have been calls to reset the Vatican's diplomacy with communist China, particularly the controversial Vatican-China deal approved by Pope Francis and shaped by Secretary of State Cardinal Pietro Parolin. here to tell us what she believes the Vatican needs to do and what this new China policy might look like is director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute, Nina Shea. Nina, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Earlier this month, you wrote a piece in First Things, which was just incredible, titled, "The Pope Needs a Better China Policy." Since that ill-advised and still secret Vatican-China deal, which was instituted in 2018, I'll remind you, it has received a ton of criticism for inexplicably allowing the Chinese communist authorities input over the appointment of Catholic bishops. The issue came into stark relief in the lead-up to this last conclave, given that Cardinal Parolin was one of the prime candidates, who presumably still manages this deal and the agreement. Nina, what is the first thing Pope Leo XIV should do to revise this policy, in your estimation? And what would a better policy look like?
Well, I think that the first thing is to really examine what has happened over the last 7 years since the agreement's been in force with the appointment of bishops. Because what we do know about the deal, it's still secret. The contents are still secret. But we do know, because it has been leaked by Cardinal Parolin, or revealed, that it's to share power in the appointment of bishops. And we do know that the government, the communist, officially atheistic government of China, has the upper hand in this. They have been appointing bishops without the Pope's consent. And in the case of Shanghai, which is the most important Catholic diocese, the largest one, it's the oldest one in China, they have the this Patriotic Association Bishops Conference president as the bishop, and he appointed himself essentially without the Pope
just
knowing,
unbelievable.
Even knowing.
And to give people a sense, and again, this gets so little reportage, Nina. I'm stunned, and I think it's part of the Vatican doesn't want to talk about it. The bishops don't want to talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about these suffering people in China, but we have to. You write at least 10. Chinese Catholic bishops are currently in indefinite detention or otherwise restricted in their ministries for opposing the government control over the church. There are also bishops who have died in the past 7 years, and those sees are just vacant. The Vatican and China have only replaced about a dozen of them, and there are, I think, something like 30 bishoprics open, empty.
Yeah.
What is the latest on the detention of these bishops? And is the Vatican at all involved in trying to gain their release?
Well, no. The answer is no. The Vatican is silent on this. And it's worse than silence. They covered it up. And I really want to emphasize this, because when Cardinal Parolin was asked at a press conference in 2020 about persecution of the church, he frankly denied that there was persecution. He said there's only regulation. And he constantly talks about being united, that the church, the episcopacy in China is now united. Well, not really, because they don't have a sharing of the mind, because the communists are replacing with their people the papally appointed bishops, who are 10 of whom are, most of them, 9 or so, are in prison. Without indefinite detention, without due process.
No due process at all.
No due process.
They're
arrested, taken away, and they're in isolation. We don't know where they are.
Here's the most insidious thing. I mean, something you said I have to pick up on. Parolin may be right. They are all united because they're all Xi apparatchiks. They're all communist officials who have just been overnight, with a wave of Xi's wand, made Catholic bishops. And then the Vatican goes in and approves these things. That's what's so heartbreaking, Nina. Why would they approve and give license to these people who are clearly not Catholic or faithful bishops?
Well, it's an erosion of papal power. It's a ceding of papal power, really, of this, under canon law, the Pope has the duty to appoint, to continue the chain.
Apostolic succession.
Yes, and it's also an erosion of his moral authority and his religious authority, because think about it. This is syncretism, what's happening with the teaching of the church. When you have communist plants in there, as the new bishop of Shanghai, talking about we're going to open this meeting of clerics, Catholic clerics, in the spirit of the Communist Congress of the 20th Congress,
right?
Communist Congress. It's not.
And they're quoting Xi.
They're quoting Xi Jinping as the president of China in their sermons. They have to. That's what they're told to do now. They have to ban children from the churches. How will they perpetuate the faith? How will they keep the orthodoxy, the magisterium of the teaching authority of the church?
Well, and insidiously, Beijing appointed two new bishops to seats already occupied by legitimate Catholic bishops the day after Pope Francis's death, okay, when there was no pope to give an approval, up or down. Nina, aside from our coverage, this is barely mentioned. How do you think Pope Leo should react to these two bishop appointments?
Well, I don't think he should approve them. I think he should say that we have bishops there in these dioceses. You've bypassed them. They are in detention. Bishop Zhang in Xinjiang diocese in Hainan, he was taken away and hasn't been seen since 2021. He had cancer surgery when he was recuperating from that when they took him. He is still alive. He's still the bishop there. And then in Shanghai, the same thing was the other appointment was for Shanghai. There are two bishops now who are living and who have been papally approved, who served with the government's permission briefly. In one case, it was less than a day. Mm-hmm. The other, but he was a member of the Patriotic Association. He has now been in prison for 11, 12 years in a seminary, isolated,
wow.
and cannot serve as his ministry at all.
And just so people can understand, what this means is there was an authentically appointed and consecrated bishop. We're going back to the 90s in one of these cases, 91, I believe, he was appointed bishop, right?
It was 2011 and 2012 in Shanghai.
Oh, okay, that more recent. Yeah. Okay. But again, these are bishops of vintage. They didn't just show up yesterday. They've been disappeared. And in their place, the communist authorities have appointed new bishops. And the Vatican is poised to accept them. This is unbelievable. And the fact that the Vatican is accepting the cover-up and the repression of the church in China. Nina, what are your hopes for reform? I mean, Pope Leo does have a great opportunity here to do something different.
Yes. And he has so much stature at this moment. This mm-hmm. is the time to do it. The whole world is full of goodwill for him, and he also has been to China. He's one of the few popes ever to have been to China. He's had their order, the Augustine Order, has a presence there and has had it for a long time. They first went there in the 16th century. So, and Pope Leo the 13th. Told them to go back in the 19th century into China, in the Augustinians,
so
as well as others.
So there's a
history here of Prevost, yes. So Pope Leo. So he was presumably as a prior, a general prior, visiting those people in Hunan province in the south. But we really don't know what he did or who he met there. But that was up until 2013. He has some feel for China. He knows something about the place. And I think that he should bargain with them and a real, you know, give and take, a real negotiation and say, I want my bishops out of detention and filling those positions.
Yeah. No, call attention to it.
Yes,
I mean, if Trump has taught them anything, negotiating with the Chinese, you got to call their bluff. And you got to make them hurt a little bit publicly in the public sphere.
At the same time, Raymond, I think that he has to revive the underground. There has been an underground there, and there's one hanging on.
What would that look like?
Well, in the last papacy, we saw them derided and ridiculed, being called by the Vatican envoy to Hong Kong of people having psychological barriers because they wouldn't join the Communist Party. And think about this. The Patriotic Association of Bishops, which is the communist structure to oversee and control these bishops, is part of the United Front Work Department of the Communist Party. So it's the propaganda arm of the Communist Party. And those who refused to join it and to express, pledge their independence from the papal authority, that is the pledge that's required for this, were derided as having psychological batteries, being stubborn, And another thing that's often said is it's just people who feel bad that we should honor those who had suffered in the past so much. It's still going on. The right. suffering is happening today. This is a human rights issue. And it's also it's a human rights crisis when you think about it. A sizable portion of the Catholic Church leadership in detention, wow. more than any other country in the world, has more bishops in detention.
Unbelievable.
And when you have Cardinal Parolin saying that this is a good agreement, it's working well, it doesn't ring true.
It's unbelievable. The more I read about it, the more I learn about it, the more I hear from people suffering under it, the angrier and more upset I get, I have to tell you, Nina, which is partially why I wanted you to come and explain to the audience. But Hong Kong authorities have proposed the creation of a mechanism that would allow mainland China to exercise jurisdiction over national security cases based on a clause in the national security law imposed by Beijing. The move would open the door to pursuing complex cases across the border. It's believed that Jimmy Lai's case would fall under this complex case rule. What do you know of this situation, and what's the latest with Jimmy Lai's trial? His son, Sebastian's going to be joining us next week.
Yeah, he's still on trial after a year and a half, and it's not expected to wrap up until the fall. Maybe his son has more information, but that's what I know. This law was presented by the local Hong Kong government to the legislature, which the Legislative Council, which rubber stamps the government's proposals now. Mm-hmm. That's the custom. So this will probably go through. This will go through. Have no doubt. This will go through. And this means that Jimmy Lai and people like him will be before a kangaroo court and will be sentenced to, maximum penalty. They will show no mercy because that's their motto. And he might end up in a prison for the rest of his life, disappeared like these bishops.
Right.
Bishop Su, since 1997, has been, and he was the one they were referring to, 1997, right. Bishop James Su.
Unbelievable.
He hasn't been seen since he was taken away by the Chinese government in 1997 and put in a prison without a trial.
It's outrageous. Well, we have to keep the attention of the world on all this. Nina Shea, I'm so glad you do. Nina Shea, thank you for being here. We will leave it there. You can find Nina's reporting on the persecution of Christians worldwide by visiting Hudson.org.
He's an actor, producer, and screenwriter, best known for his iconic films and TV roles in Steven Spielberg's Minority Report, Band of Brothers, and so many other projects, Yellowstone, Tulsa King. He's also a devout Catholic husband and father of five. His latest film, which he co-wrote and co-produced with his wife, is The Last Rodeo from Angel Studios. It opens in theaters on Friday, May 23rd. Here to tell us about it, please welcome Neil McDonough to the show. Neil, thanks for taking the time. I know you're on set this week. I know you're doing Tulsa King with my pal Sly, so we're going to make this quick because I don't want to upset him. Let's talk about The Last Rodeo, Neil.
Well, if there's one thing I know about Sly, if it's talking about the great Catholic Church, he would tell me, take my time and enjoy the moment.
Okay, well, I'm going to hold him to that then. Let's talk about The Last Rodeo. You wrote this script, and in the movie, you play this down-and-out rodeo star who really makes a major decision to return to the sport. Tell me where this story came from, Neil.
Well, you know, it's funny. When I'm not around Reveille and the kids, I was doing a film called The Warrant, Breaker's Law, and we're filming in Arizona that Reveille and I were producing the film, but she was home with the kids. And whenever I'm away from Reveille, I just get melancholy and sad, and I don't like being on location. I consider it kind of a prison sentence. But this one day in particular, I was driving home and I got gut punched with this thought that what would ever happen to me if something happened to Reveille? And I pulled over to the side of the road, just kind of buckled, and then this other thought entered my head that I know is a gift from him. And it was, write a movie about Rocky on a bull where you have to go save your grandson because he's dying from the same brain tumor that your wife died from. I don't know where that came from. And I told Reveille, I called her, I said, I got this great idea. And she said, well, voice dictate it into your phone, which is how I usually start my scripts.
Yeah.
And I sat there in the side of the 10 freeway for 2 hours while semis were ripping by me, voice dictating and crying and laughing the outline of The Last Rodeo. And then a week later, my writing partner and I wrote the first draft. And then a week later, Reveille and I found, Reveille in particular, found the financing, and Angel jumped on board. And 2 years almost to the date, here we are. And I'm so blessed and fortunate because of it.
Incredible. And I saw shadows, and maybe I'm reading too much into this, but I saw shadows of your own journey in this story. I mean, in 2010, some of our viewers will know, you were fired from a show, Scoundrels, mainly because you didn't want to do love scenes on camera with someone other than your spouse, which, you know, is normally a commendable thing, but not in Hollywood. After that, you didn't work for a few years. Tell me what happened.
Oh, boy. That was, you know, I've had a lot of people die on me in my life, and I've had lots of horrible things, as we all have. But that was, that may have been the toughest moment of my life, because for 2 years I didn't work. I didn't have any money. And, we lost our house. We lost our cars. We lost everything. So it was really hard. And then I remember one day when things were just got so bad, and I was drinking tons of alcohol, and I was trying to drown it and trying to just hide it from everyone. Certainly wasn't hiding it from Reveille. And one day I said, Lord, why have you forgotten all about me? And as soon as that came out of my mouth, Raymond, and you know, we talked about it before, I fell to the ground in tears, realizing I was making this whole journey about my pain instead of what was happening to Reveille and the kids and everyone else around me. And from that second forward, I just changed, and I stopped drinking alcohol and started going to church daily, and really started to rev my engine back up and get closer to him. And 10 years later now, whatever it is, Reveille and I are about to start our 11th production together.
Wow.
All of our films give glory to him. And we're so blessed and fortunate that sometimes you need to go through a crucifixion to realize what the glory is all about. And I went through mine, and I don't wish it to anybody else, but it's good. It's good to be called out and see what you're really made of at times. And so the story with Joe Wainwright in this film is semi-autobiographical with my life and the pain that I went through when he lost his wife, and how he got through it and how he failed getting through it. And then finally he was called out, and what is he going to do to protect his family and provide for his family? And that's what the movie's really about. Yes, there's bull riding, and the bull riding sequences are just
incredible.
Unbelievable. And John Avnet, the amazing director, pulled out all the tricks. PBR backed us 100%. They gave us their riders, got to use their real names, gave us the bulls, kitted out the arena to make you feel like you were actually at a PBR event in the movie.
Well,
and I'm so
and you, Neil, we should tell people, you do a lot of these stunts in the movie. And tell us how you prepared for this. I know you were, there's a mechanical bull not far from your house, and you were a frequent visitor
for
a while.
Yeah, you know, I haven't been to a nightclub in, I can't tell you how many years, ever since I gave up alcohol. But there was a nightclub right around the corner from my house where I trained so often for months and months and months beforehand. But Buddy Joe Hooker, our stunt coordinator, you know, I've been riding horses since I was a little boy, but he had me riding horses all the time, just getting in the saddle, getting to work, doing the things. Because what we didn't want to do is have any authentic, true bull rider think, meh. So we worked hard to make sure there was none of that. So Kyle Sherwood, a champion himself in the PBR, coached me daily. And I worked so hard to make sure that we're doing it right. And bumps and bruises and, you know, separated shoulder and cranked up some ribs and a few things along the way. It was worth every bit of it, because I knew something important was happening. I knew that we were making a film that was going to give glory to God. And and for that, beat the heck out of me. I'm fine.
I was hurting watching you, pal. I'm watching this movie going,
When I got launched off that one time and I landed on the ground, John thought that I died. Avnet was like, oh my gosh, what just happened? But it was worth it. It was, it's an incredible film. And, you know, I get to finally do what I've never done in a movie before. I get to be the hero and kiss the girl in the end. And that girl that I kissed the end is none other than my wife, Reveille. So,
yeah, well, I love you. You ruined one of my questions. That was my full circle moment.
Sorry,
I love that.
Sorry.
No. I love that you finally get to kiss the girl in the end, you know, and it ends up being the wife that you really gave up a piece of your career for some years ago, which I thought was so beautiful seeing that moment.
I wouldn't say that I gave up a piece of my career. I think that, you know, the choices you make define what kind of man you are. And the choices that I make were just the choices that fit for me. Some other guys can do certain things and whatever. I don't judge. Look, we all make mistakes. Mm-hmm. We're all sinners. None of us are perfect. There's only one who is perfect. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to try to emulate, to be as close to Jesus as you can, to be the man that you can be and try to always do the right things is what we should always strive for.
Well, Neil,
and that's what we did in this film, and I'm just blessed to be part of all of this.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film and emotionally gripping. It's there's action. I mean, you've had an incredible career, we should say, from Captain America to the Band of Brothers to, of course, Tulsa King and Yellowstone. Years ago, though, you may have forgotten this, Neil, I produced a Truth and Life audio Bible, and we cast you as Jesus. But for whatever reason, these casting directors keep offering you villain roles. Why do you think that is?
Well, I won't kiss another woman on screen. So that leaves two things, Raymond. I can either be the villain or I can be a soldier in the middle of a war with no women around. So I'm always searching for those things. But thank goodness for Angel Studios and taking a shot on me with, you know, The Shifted very well.
Yeah, that's right.
And then Homestead started seeing me going into the good guy range. Mm-hmm. And then they had faith in me for this. And investors all had faith in me that because they knew who I really was and what I was striving for. And to finally get to play the hero is something that I've always wanted. I always wanted to be John Wayne in the Cowboys. Yeah. I always wanted to be those types of guys. And I finally get to play that character who's really as close to me as possible.
Yeah.
But back to the audio tape of playing Jesus.
Yeah.
That was my first job back after everything had happened.
Wow.
And I can't tell you
know that.
What an amazing gift that was, because it was without question the hardest thing I've ever done. For months and months and months, we'd be in the booth, and I remember the person who was running the director on the show, every once in a while we'd just stop because we felt it. And we knew that Jesus was in the room when we were doing it. It was just so emotional. And the carpet that I stood on for those 3 or 4 months when I was doing it, I had that carpet at home, and I step on it all the time to kind of ground myself and make me realize, okay, what is my job? My job is to work for him, and I'm going to do the best that I can to make sure that my boss is happy with everything that I do in every aspect of life, as a dad, as a husband, and as a movie and TV star.
Well,
movies and TVs are distant third place between God, family, and then this work.
Well, that, you know,
and country,
work,
too.
Your work on that audio Bible, I have to say, I may put a link up for it just so people can hear it. Your performance there is so beautiful, understated, powerful at moments, but deeply felt. We were all blown away. I remember when I first heard it, and I thought, oh, my gosh. You know, it was just incredible.
And then they have the Pope bless it and say, you know, we can use this as a tool to spread Catholicism throughout the world. I was like,
yeah,
Pope Benedict. Are you kidding me?
It was special.
It was one of my favorite things I've ever done.
I love that. Well, The Last Rodeo is also, it fits you like a glove. It hits theaters on May 23rd, Memorial Day, co-produced by you and your wife. You play, as you mentioned, Joe Wainwright, who's an aging champion bull rider who's been widowed, and he's facing a whole new set of family crises. Here's a taste of The Last Rodeo.
Cody needs surgery. I can't afford it. I have no money.
How are you feeling?
I told you I've got this.
I want to ride like the wind for my grandson.
Can't stop me now. Not getting hurt. Hey,
I can't keep blaming you. I just gotta let go and move forward.
Joe Wainwright, 3-time world champ, rides again for Cody.
That's a genuine, true legend right there.
Focus.
It's not my first rodeo, Pops.
Is this what, your 10th project working with your wife? Was this movie the 10th?
Yep. It's, you know, we started with a $350,000 budget on a movie called Redstone, and then we did part two of that called Boone, and that was 1.5, and Reveille raised the money for that, and then we did The Warrant and The Warrant Part 2, and The Greater was our first one, and then we started doing films with Angel, and you've done a couple of other films in between, but when it's an Angel film, and it's the McDonough Company alongside Angel, you know it's going to be a film that makes you think about, how can I be a better person? What can I do as a man or a woman to get closer to him? Yeah. And I love being able to play in that arena. And that's what I've always aspired to do. That's the opportunity that we have now, and we're going to keep doing it until my last breath, because I love being in the position to be able to tell stories that not just some people can go to, but the whole family can go to. And you don't have to be Catholic or Christian. You can be Jewish and agnostic, Buddhist, Muslim. It doesn't matter. They're morality plays. And at the end, someone has to go through a very difficult time and get through it with faith. Yeah. And those are the motifs that we really love playing with. And gosh, we're so blessed to have The Last Rodeo coming out this weekend.
Yeah, well, but it's a beautiful,
as I've said,
go ahead.
Anyone out there who loves these types of films where you can bring the whole family and not worrying about covering eyes and ears and wondering if kids are going to be okay or if grandparents are going to be okay. This is a film where everyone can go see the film. Everyone can be entertained by the amazing bullet riding, but everyone's going to feel the emotion of the film because it's truly about a fractured family. Mm. What happens when you have a fractured relationship with your daughter? My wife has passed away. I have a grandson now. He's sick. Mm. Well, what am I prepared to do to provide for this family? And every single mom and dad goes through that. So this is a family film. It's got edge to it. It's got action to it. It's got all those things you want in a really great movie. But it has that faith backdrop that I'm so proud of.
Yeah, no, it's a wild ride, and it has real meaning. I mean, you come away full after seeing this movie. What do you want people to take from this movie?
Exactly what you said. I want them to be full of life when they leave the theater. Mm. We've shown it now to several different places. And, you know, I've been in movies where as soon as the credits start to roll, people start to leave.
Yeah.
The Last Rodeo, not a single person moves out of their seats because they're so emotionally struck and It just, whenever I think about it, I get choked up because I'm that God has chosen Revee and I to make movies that give glory to him. What more could you ask for as a human being who's a faithful guy? Well, I can't think of anything more.
Neil, I've been a longtime fan of your work, but I am equally a fan of the way you've conducted yourself as an actor and as a Catholic actor. And I think, and I hope, all of the viewers and listeners of this show will go see The Last Rodeo. It's an incredible movie, and the entire family can go see it, and you'll come away with something so much more than I think is being offered to us, you know, at the Cineplex and on the streamers. The Last Rodeo, starring Neil McDonough, hits theaters Friday, May 23rd. Visit angel.com/Last Rodeo. They have the theater times, show times, tickets in your area. Neil, thank you for being here. We'll catch up with you again soon, I hope.
God bless you, Raymond. Thank you. And everyone, if you love these types of films, you got to support it and tell Hollywood, enough with the darker stuff. Let's go make films again that the whole family can go and enjoy together. So buy one ticket, buy 10 tickets, buy a whole theater if you can. Whatever you've got, support this film, and it'll cause so much in Hollywood that they'll have to realize, okay, these films do make money, they're commercially successful, and they're really good at the same time. So thank you, Raymond.
And if you've seen what this poor man went through to bring you this movie, just physically, it's worth the price of admission, I promise. Neil, thank you for being here. We'll talk to you soon.
You're awesome, Raymond. Thank you. God bless you. Thank you.
Before we go tonight, America's oldest living Catholic bishop, the former bishop of Corpus Christi, Texas, Rene Gracita, is in need of our prayers. At 102, Bishop Gracita is currently hospitalized. He's in critical condition, suffering from sepsis. He is a native of New Orleans. He served as a fighter pilot in World War II, and he's a tireless defender of the unborn and supporter of the traditional Latin Mass and an old friend. Please remember Bishop Gracita in your prayers as he faces this crisis. That is all the time we have for now, and we wish you all a blessed Memorial Day. I hope you take a moment to remember our fallen heroes, and be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.